Well, we've been looking at the parable of the two sons, sometimes called the parable of the lost son or the prodigal son, but it's really about two sons. And we've looked at the younger son, and we saw ourselves, God be merciful to me, a sinner. Christian friend, I've walked out on God, rejected his love, wasted my life in the far country, and only when I was perishing in the pigsty did I come to my senses. And so I returned, emaciated, caked in filth. And I came with my little prepared speech, didn't I? Verse 18, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. And what did the Lord do? Is he a hard man? Did he whip us to within an inch of our lives? Did we have to make amends for our sin, make it up to God? Did we have to, as it were, slave away for the next 20 years as a hired servant to win his acceptance? Did we have to prove ourselves with one anxious performance after another to win back his love? What did the Lord do? Well, we're told verse 20. He arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and he ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. God ran to meet us with open arms, and he never gave me a chance, did he, to say, make me like one of your hired servants. Prove yourself, I'll have none of it, he said. And he welcomed me back, not as a hired servant, he welcomed me back as a son, with no account of the extravagance. He lavished his love upon us, and he met the whole cost of our salvation himself, even to the giving of his own son. And my tears of repentance became tears of joy. And the father himself led the celebrations. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be merry. Christian friends, the grace of God. And then we looked at the older son. And again we saw ourselves, God be merciful to me, a Pharisee. Because all of us to varying degrees have yet to fully understand the grace of God. We still feel in some way that God's love is conditional. I have to prove myself. I have to win his blessing. One anxious performance after another. Have I done enough? Trying to prove, trying to win his love. Try harder, do better. Lo, these many years I've been slaving for you, says the older son. And of course it explains why, like the older son, there are times when we get angry. Because when things go wrong, well, God is not keeping his side of the contract, is he? I've been slaving for him, where's the blessing? It's not fair. And I'm angrier still if God blesses someone who I think is less deserving than me. Like a younger son. Verse 28, but he was angry and would not go in. And of course it explains, Christian friends, why so much of our service for the Lord is joyless. I spent too long in the field. Not spent enough time with the Father. His heartbeat hasn't been my heartbeat. And so instead of rejoicing in the wonderful grace of God, in the love of God, and walking with him, I've been too busy trying to prove my worth. And I see the Christian life as a series of tasks to perform. There are things I have to do. That's my Christian life. My Christian life is meetings, doings, things. Instead of cultivating my relationship with him. And it's joyless slavery. Verse 29, lo, these many years I have been serving you, slaving for you. I never transgressed your commandments at any time. You never gave me a young goat that I may make merry with my friends. You know, not even the least of your merry. You didn't even give me a young goat after all I've done for you. And it explains, Christian friends, why we can be hard on others. Verse 30, but as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. If my security is based on how well I'm doing, then of course the more I put others down, the more secure I'll feel, because I'm doing better than they are. And if I'm doing better than they are, then I'll feel more secure in my relationship with the Lord. And so finding fault comes easily. It's funny, isn't it? If I don't get grace, if I don't understand the grace of God, and I can be a Christian for 50 years and not really fully understand the grace of God, I'll be angry, joyless, critical. And brothers and sisters, if you've been in church life any length of time, you'll know it in your own heart, getting angry over things. A joyless, oh, do I have to? And the ease with which we pull each other down. We call ourselves Reformed Christians, the ones who are supposed to understand grace. So, Christian friends, can you see yourself? Have you yet to understand the grace of God? And we can understand it as theological things which are written down, can't we? We can understand grace in terms of it's written down. And I can give you a good definition of grace, and I can talk to someone who says, what's grace? And I'll go through it and give them the scriptures. But have I understood grace in the very depth, the very bottom of my heart? Has it taken root there? Remember the last time the Father came out to plead with you to go in? We left it there, didn't we? Did you go in? Or did you leave the service as you came in? And since we spoke about these things, you've been critical of people, you've been joyless, you've been angry about things, pulled people down. The Father was pleading with you to go in. Did you go in? Has anything changed? Well, today we're back again in Luke 15. Because we really need to hammer this nail, don't we? Fundamental that we grasp grace. Now, do you remember the definition of grace? Simon put together this definition. Just caught it, didn't it? What's grace? Well, here was our definition. Far from being an impersonal force, power, or energy, grace is the loving heart and hand of the living, covenant-keeping God, freely, unconditionally, generously, choosing, calling, quickening, pardoning, accepting, sanctifying, preserving, and glorifying his undeserving and unlovely but deeply cherished people, and giving himself in the entirety of his being powers and indeed life to them, purely because of the Son's saving work and their union with him. You see, it's all of God, all of grace. It's undeserved. It's for the unlovely. And that's exactly the point. God himself runs to meet us. God himself gives himself to us. And the reason for his love for his people is not found in his people, is it? There's nothing lovely in us, nothing desirable in us. God doesn't get a good deal. It all flows unconditionally from him. It's love for the unlovely. It's love for the undeserving. If we can say it reverently, it's hardwired into God. He's the God who delights in hesed, in covenant love, in unchanging love. The New Testament word for it is grace. It all flows unconditionally from him, because that is the God that he is. He's the loving God. Now, Christian friends, if we were to make real progress in the Christian life, If we're to conquer sin, if we're to live for him, then we must grasp grace. Have you heard of Thomas Chalmers? He was a brilliant mathematician, but he was even a greater man of God. He's a tremendous preacher, formidable theologian, and he was a leading light, not just in Scottish evangelicalism, but in fact in the United Kingdom and in North America. And though he died in 1847, his influence is still felt today through his writings. And one of his greatest sermons was entitled The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. So what did he say? Well, he said the human heart, if I can paraphrase it, the human heart is hungry. Hungry to be filled. And filled it is. It's filled with the love of self, the love of sin, the love of this world. Now, says Chalmers, can the heart unfill itself? No. Can it empty itself of its love of self, its love of sin, its love of this world? No. Which is why, says Chalmers, you can preach about the evils of this world. You can talk about the wickedness of sin. You can talk about the madness of living for self. And you can say, it's such a life, it defiles, it corrupts, it destroys, it ends in hell fire. He says you can marshal all the arguments. You can have your congregation in front of you. You can berate them, browbeat them, compel them. And people, as they sit there, they'll be challenged. They'll be convicted. They'll weep over their sin. They're resolved to go back and to live new lives. And he says, and by Monday morning, they're embracing their old sins. Nothing's changed. They go back to where they were. Why? Because the human heart can't unfill itself. It can't finish with its love of self, its love of sin, its love of this world. It can't break free of those things. It can't empty itself of the love of those things. So what's to be done? Elsa Chalmers, what's to be done is to preach the gospel. To preach the gospel of God's grace. And the more freely you preach it, he said, the better it is. Man was a reformed man. That's the formation of the Free Church of Scotland. Preach the freedom of the gospel, he said. Grace, it's free. Why? Because you see, when, like the younger son, I see that God welcomes sinners, that he freely forgives me, he freely accepts me, when I see the love of God for me, for someone so miserable and unlovely, but he loves me, what happens? Says Chalmers, the heart melts. And my heart is conquered by a greater love than the love of sin, than the love of self, than the love of this world. My heart is then conquered by the love of Christ. A love so free, so wonderful, so strong that it expels all other loves. The strong man is displaced by a stronger man. The love of sin is kicked out by the love of Jesus. See, the heart hasn't, as it were, just been unfilled of its sinful loves and then left empty. That's not how it works. You can't do that. What has happened is the love of God has poured in. And it leaves no room for these other loves. They get pushed out. They get chased away. Hence the title of his sermon, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. When our love for Christ rushes in, what does it do? It expels all other loves. That is the expulsive power. It doesn't dribble away. Let me quote him. Never does a sinner find within himself so mighty a moral transformation as when under the belief that he is saved by grace. He feels constrained thereby to offer his heart a devoted thing. He gives his heart freely to God. And to deny all ungodliness. Now, Christian men, none of these things are strange to us, are they? You know, if you tell Jacob to work for Laban for 7 years, what's Jacob going to say? I don't know what he's going to say, but he's going to say, no chance. Work for him for 7 years? You've got to be kidding. Yeah, but you tell Jacob to work for Laban for 7 years, and at the end of those 7 years, he'll get Rachel. Oh, that's different, isn't it? And what does it say? Genesis 29, verse 20. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. It was nothing, was it, to slave away for Uncle Laban? Because I can see Rachel, I can hear her footsteps, she's talking to me. It's Rachel, it's a few days, it's nothing. Because the love of Rachel has come in and taken possession of his heart. You tell a young man to give up his independence. Give up his money, give up his football. Give up his lazy, dirty habits. And he won't, will he? But when he meets the girl of his dreams, he abandons those things with ease that he might possess her. Because he gives up one sort of freedom to find a greater freedom. And the love of her expels the love of those other things. Well, as Chalmers says, you tell a man to set fire to his house, okay, all that he owns is in his house, set fire to your house. He's not going to do it, is he? But if you tell him that he'll get a house 10 times the beauty and worth appearing from the ashes of the house he's just set fire to, he'll do it. Do it straight away. Because of what he's getting. And it's the expulsive power of a new affection. Christian friends, the love of God, the grace of God, the experience of the younger son is to conquer my heart. Why is it some sins cling to me, Christian friends? Why is it there are some habits that I've developed have held me back in the Christian life maybe for decades? And I know I shouldn't, I know it's wrong, and I know it shouldn't be there, but somehow I just can't seem to break free. But how many times have you gone here on a Sunday filled with resolutions? It's going to be different, it's going to change. And come Monday, you're back to where you were. And why does Christ's call, when he says, deny self, take up your cross, follow me, why does that call sound like a threat? It's going to spoil things. Why do I not make progress in the Christian life like I long to? Why is there in my life so little change? Is it because I have still yet to grasp the grace of God? And there's more of the older son in me than I care to know. That I live like a hired servant. I keep trying to prove myself. I keep trying to earn God's blessing. Lo, these many years I've been slaving for you. And I'm trying to unfill my heart of its sin. I'm trying to unfill my heart of its love of self. I'm trying to unfill my heart of its love of the world. And I'm trying to do it. Try harder. Do better. Come on. When all the time my heart needs to be conquered by his love. A love that progressively expels the love of sin, the love of self, the love of this world. And what John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. But you turn it round the other way. If the love of the Father is in me, then there'll be no room for the love of this world, will there? So let's apply these things to two areas. Well, we'll come back to it, God willing, next week, but two areas today. The first is our service for the Lord. Now, those two sons, the younger and the older, which one is going to serve his father better? Is it going to be the younger son? What does he know? Well, he knows he's forgiven, freely accepted, freely loved. His father's embraced him, hasn't he? He's lavished his love upon him. It's extraordinary. The father said, bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. He's come barefoot. And bring the fatted calf here and kill it and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead, is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. What is going to be the response of that son to his father's requests? Well, his heart is full of gratitude, isn't it? Full of joy, full of thankfulness. And when, therefore, his father speaks to him and makes a request, well, nothing's too much trouble. I'll do anything. Because he's freely loved. What about the service of the older son? The older son, what does he know? Well, he's not sure what he knows, is he? Does my father love me? I've been slaving away. I've always kept your commands and you're not even giving me a goat. Does my father really love me? Am I accepted? Many years, never transgressed your commandment any time, never gave me a young goat. And you can see the arithmetic going on inside him. You can almost hear the little cogs clicking away, can't you? Maybe I haven't done enough. Maybe I haven't proved my worth. But hey, this son hasn't proved his worth. And look at what he gets. And I've tried to prove my worth. And I didn't get a goat. Maybe I'll have to slave harder to get his blessing. So which of those two sons is going to serve his father better? Charles Spurgeon put it like this. So there was a wonderful king. And among his subjects was a humble gardener. And this gardener, he so loved the king, he so esteemed the king, that he gave to the king, he presented him with a bunch of carrots. And the king, seeing this man's love, he gave him a plot of ground so he could grow even more carrots. Well, one of the king's courtiers was watching. He thought, an acre of land for a bunch of carrots. That's a good deal. So next day the courtier gave to the king a magnificent horse. What did the king do? Bunch of carrots gets you an acre of land. A magnificent horse. And the courtier's eyes widened. What am I going to get for that? So what did the king do? The king simply said, thank you. And nothing more. And much like our older son, the courtier was upset. He thought to himself, well, that's not fair. He gives a bunch of carrots and gets a field. I give this magnificent steed and all I get is a thank you. So the king said to him, well, the gardener gave the carrots to me. He gave them to me. You gave the horse to yourself. He did it simply because he loved me. You did it simply to get something back. An unspoken contract. Not grace, but works. Something conditional. If I do this, then I'll get this. If I give this horse, boy, what's the king going to give me? And you see, the courtier didn't love the king, did he? He loved himself. He was doing it for himself. His great displays of devotion to the king were actually just for himself. Didn't love the king, loved himself. His actions, his service were motivated by self. The king was simply the means to an end, to get what he wanted. So which of those sons is going to serve his father better? You see, Christian friends, if my heart is filled with the love of the Lord, I'll do it for him. But if I'm not sure that he loves me, and I've got to prove things, I'll do it for me. And which will carry my service further, love for Christ or love for me? Just turn back a few chapters to Luke chapter 7. Luke 7, verse 36. Then one of the Pharisees asked him, that's Jesus, to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with fragrant oil. What do you see? This woman is costly, isn't it? It's extravagant. She's washing his feet with her tears. The towel is the hair of her head. She takes this costly oil and anoints his feet. It goes way beyond the call of duty. Why does she do it? Why does she waste all this money on this fragrant oil? Why does she give herself so freely? Why is it that she can't stop herself? She knows he's there. She goes seeking after him. Why? Well, Jesus himself tells us, doesn't he? Verse 44, he says to his host, Simon, he turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss. This woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Do you see her extravagant service? It comes from a heart that is overflowing with love and thankfulness. It's a heart that's overflowing with love for Jesus. And why? Because of what he's done for her. She was a great sinner. Everyone knew this woman. Everyone knew she had a ruined reputation. Everyone knew she'd messed up big time. And she was dirty. She was unclean. She was a sinner. But she'd found Jesus, obviously, before this meeting. And he'd freely, freely forgiven her. And freely forgiven, she freely loves. And as far as she's concerned, no service is too costly. He has everything. He has my life. He has all that I have. It's all for him. I'll do anything for Jesus. It's never a waste of time. Never a waste of money. She's never going to think, what's in this for me? So, Christian friend, if I identify with the younger son, what have I to be proud of? I'm a pig, stinking sinner. That's all I am. But then Jesus has saved me, hasn't he? And if I really grasp that, freely, freely forgiven. None of us have little sins to be forgiven. We're all great, great sinners. Then my heart will be filled with love for him. And nothing will seem too much for him. So, Christian friend, what about my service? Is it unself-consciously costly? Is it extravagant like this woman? Is it joyful? Will I do it when there is nothing in it for me? I think that's the test, isn't it? You know, we'll serve the Lord if there's something in it for me. I get something back. But will I serve the Lord? Will I do it for him when actually there is nothing apparently in it for me? Well, maybe, Christian friends, that's the rub, isn't it? There are things you won't do because there's nothing in it for you. I won't serve the Lord in this area because I don't get anything back from it. Or do I say, well, Lord, I'll do it whatever because you're everything to me. And doing it for you is its own reward. That's all I want to do, to show my love, to show my affection, to show my devotion. That's its own reward. I don't care about anything else. I'll do it for you. He's the king, isn't he? What does he need from me? But I'll gladly give him, if you like, my bunch of carrots. Because I love him. David Livingstone said, the explorer and the missionary in Africa. He said, people talk of the sacrifice I have made in spending so much of my life in Africa. Can that be labeled sacrifice? Which is simply paid as a small part of the great debt owed to God, which we can never repay. And then he says, I never made a sacrifice. That's a man in love with God, isn't it? What do you mean sacrifice? That was nothing. I did it for him. It was a debt of love. What else do you expect me to do? Now, don't talk of sacrifice. There was no sacrifice made. It was a debt of love freely, freely paid. You see, it's the expulsive power, isn't it, of a new affection. So, Christian friend, has the grace of God captured your heart? You'll see it in the spirit of your service. You'll never say, what's in it for me? You never say, I'll only do it if I get something measurable back. I won't be stopping myself and thinking, oh, no, that's just too much hassle. It'll be unself-conscious because it's for him and he has everything. Therefore, I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. And you know that because she loves me so much. Well, the second thing is our attitude to sin. Again, of the two sons, which of the two sons will please his father better? The one who's doing it for himself, for what he can get back, or the one who's going to be driven by his love for his father? Now, Christian friends, we know sin is wretched, don't we? It is, isn't it? Yes? I mean, sin promises pleasure, but it always delivers pain. It promises freedom, but it delivers slavery. It promises fulfillment and satisfaction, and what does it give us? Grief and emptiness. Sin promises delight, and what does it deliver? Everlasting misery. And yet for all that, you have and I have darling sins. And somehow in the madness of it all, it's those sins that give me the pain, and yet somehow I feel if I continue in those sins, they'll relieve the pain. It's those sins that are making me a slave, and that's why I keep going back to them. And those sins don't satisfy, so I'm constantly left empty, so I keep going back to the sins looking for satisfaction. And you can tell me how wicked and terrible and awful this sin is, and you let the thunders of Sinai terrify me, but somehow on Monday morning I go and do it all over again, don't I? So what's to be done? How can I please the Lord? But again, remember, the heart can't unfill itself. And no amount of arguing and berating and browbeating will make you give up the love of your darling sins. It can't be done. The link can only be broken by a greater love displacing my love for sin. The man who's head over heels in love with his wife, the man who's intoxicated with the love of his wife, is not going to be a man who goes and commits adultery, is he? You see, we come at sin the wrong way. But if I delight in Jesus, and freely forgiven, I freely love, then sin progressively loses its appeal. It loses its power over me. In Greek mythology, the sirens, they would sing songs to draw the sailors irresistibly to the rocks and to their destruction. So in Greek mythology, Odysseus, he had the ears of his crew filled with wax so they couldn't hear the songs of the sirens, and then he had his crew tie him to the mast. So as they rowed close to the rocks and the sirens started singing, well, the crew couldn't hear the sirens, and Odysseus couldn't escape his bindings. Even though he was shouting, let me off, let me to the sirens, he couldn't get away from his bindings. Is that the Bible's solution to sin? Bind me to the mast. I really want it, but tie me down. Orpheus, on the other hand, what did he do? Well, he had a harp. And he played such beautiful music on his harp that his sailors ignored the seductions of the sirens. The music of his harp was more beautiful than the songs of the sirens. So the sailors wanted just to listen to the harp, and they weren't drawn to the voice that would bring them to their destruction. Christian friend, if you're in love with Jesus, if I see what he did for me, and we'll think about this probably more next week, that he loved me, he gave himself for me, if I taste and see just how good God is, then sin loses its power. Sin loses its attraction. And the love of Jesus, it progressively expels from my life the love of sin. It won't happen all at once, and some darling sins will be there perhaps even to the end. But their power will be progressively lessened and broken as the love of Jesus floods in. So, Christian friend, what are you addicted to? Are you addicted to pornography? It's only a click away, isn't it? Are you addicted to body image? So concerned about the way you look. Everything can wait till things are right. Are you addicted to what others think about you? Very concerned about what others are going to say, what others are going to think. So concerned. Everything else can take second place, but I've got to appear in the eyes of others a certain sort of person. Are you addicted to self-pity? Which is why you're so touchy about things. Are you addicted to the love of money or what money can buy? You just can't stop yourself from shopping. Feel a bit miserable, go shopping. Are you addicted to laziness? You know, you set my alarm early, I'm going to get up and meet with the Lord, but it never happens. You won't get free from these things by being told off. The cure is the love of Jesus taking possession of your soul. Maybe it's not something explicit. Maybe it's not an explicit sin. Maybe it's just a habit you've got into. And it's not explicitly sinful, but it's a habit, it's an attitude, it's a way of life, and it's been holding you back in the Christian life for years. And people have been talking to you about it, speaking to you about it. You know all the arguments, and here we go again. And they put on the record, and they tell you certain things, but nothing actually changes. And the answer is to see it in a different light, isn't it? If it's been holding me back in my Christian life all these years, and I keep saying, well, it's not wrong, it's okay, it's not that bad, but what's it doing? It's keeping me from my true love. It's keeping me back from my profoundest happiness. Maybe that's why I feel miserable half the time. Because it's eating away. Because it's keeping me from my Jesus. The days I might have spent enraptured with him have been taken up with these other things. Well, I didn't actually need to. And maybe it's time to open up that compartment of my life and let the love of Christ flood in. And the light of his glory and grace, I'll wonder what I ever once saw in those things. Well, Christian friend, it's time to close, isn't it? If we understand grace, let's put it the other way. If I don't understand grace, my service will always be conditional. I will always be asking, what's in it for me? And if I can't see what's in it for me, I won't do it. I might do it because someone's pushing me into it or forcing me into it or I feel manipulated enough to go and do it or I feel bad enough to go and do it. But actually, I won't do it for him. And maybe that's how I think of Amy and Park Chapel. You know, what's in Amy and Park Chapel for me? It's okay sometimes. Other times, I'll stick with it a bit longer. But what's in it for me? And if I can't see the point, I'm not committed. If I can see the point and get something back for it, I will be committed. And I'm behaving like the older brother. And if I don't understand grace, sin, whatever arguments you marshal, and you can have them stacked up in ranks, and you can bring the cavalry in and the heavy artillery, and you can give me every reason why I should get rid of those sins. But unless the love of Christ comes pouring in to push those things away, they'll be with me to my dying day. And those things which dog my life, those weights and attitudes which have kept me back for so long, nothing is going to change until I grasp the grace of God. What I need to experience, what you need to experience, Christian friends, brothers and sisters, is the expulsive power of a new affection.